from the extremes all the way to self-examination today.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
We started this in the previous episode. If you didn't get to hear it, I will invite you to go back, sort of catch up with where we are, because I wanted to lay the foundation, recognizing that the divisiveness, the polarity that is the hallmark of today's society, in America at least, well, and actually it's around the world, began a long time ago. And not only did it begin a long time ago, but it began about exactly the same issues that are dividing us today. And so I gave an example in Texas history that I thought was, well, it was interesting to me. Hopefully it was interesting to some of you as well. And then mentioned that I wanted to go from there to where some of those issues divide us today, not for the purpose of trying to resolve the issues, but for the purpose of showing, in one sense, just showing that each side does have an argument for why they are in such fear about what the other side is doing, which is what our culture looks like right now. I'm not even being insulting by introducing the concept of fear. It's the language everyone uses. If we let that happen, it will destroy our country. On both sides, people are using that language. You can believe it's true on one side or the other, I understand. And so I'm not trying to pick a side today, even though I have my opinions about everything. I mentioned that last time. My point is not to try to talk about each issue and then resolve it, but to talk about each issue and say, yeah, we can understand why you're afraid on this side, but can you understand why they're afraid on that side? Not even so that I can get you to say, oh, well, let's just all get together and hug. I think it'll all be okay if we just get a group hug going. I'm not even pretending that. I just want to make the point that we don't have to be fearful people. And something's gone wrong when those of us, and I'm including myself, when we are living in such fear that we're not acting like ourselves. And people I know and love aren't acting like themselves. And I'm including myself, as I love myself so much. The reality is, we can do better than this, and I think it might help us to understand where some of that fear might be emerging. And so again, I encourage you to go back and listen to the previous episode because it does lay some foundation for this that I think might give a little more credence to the things I'm going to be saying, including the reference to Elizabeth Newman at the very end of that episode, a guest speaker we had in-house. Definitely a book worth reading there, The Kingdom of Rage, if you get an opportunity to. Okay, all of that said, I want to move it into the contemporary context now. And this isn't even a pattern. What I'm going to be doing now, talking about contemporary issues in the sort of from each side, not arguing for each side, but just showing why each side has so much fear or why they raise it to such a high level of importance. And these are important issues. So when I did this on the issue of abortion a while back, it's episode 80. It's called Out of Sight. You can go to our website and search for it. You might be able to search for it on the podcast servers, but sometimes they limit it to like 90 episodes or something. And I think we're 150 or more episodes since I did that one. But it was to make the point that while I am extremely pro-life, I'm for preserving life from conception, while I favor that, it's not like the pro-choice side is running around saying, let's kill babies. There is something different going on there. And so I pointed it out in that episode. We talked all through that. Today I'm doing something similar, but just not with that issue. And it's not to make the point that the other side is right, the other side being left or right. It's not to say that it's correct. It's to say there's a reason they're making these statements. There's a reason they're holding this position. And unfortunately, the reason right now is fear. The thing exacerbating all the anxiety in our society right now. Ooh, I like that. Anxiety in society. We need to write a song about it. Anyway, the thing exacerbating all of that anxiety right now is fear. It is fear of the opposite extreme. For those who are on the right, which I'm more inclined to the right, it's fear of the extreme left. For those who are on the left, it's fear of the extreme right. And I'm not even saying it's irrational fear. There are some frightening things happening right now, and we've seen evidence of that in the kind of violence that has emerged in our culture. So just, you know, using that example for a moment of all some of the violence that has emerged on the left, so I'm going to start on this side. Why would there be such a fear about something? Here's the something. So if people are on the left, or even a lot of people in the middle, and I'm going to say that about both. When I say on the left and in the middle, some people are in stunned disbelief. I'm going to say that in a minute about people who are on the right and in the middle. On the left and in the middle, there is a stunned disbelief in many people about the violence being used by ICE that was used recently by ICE in Minnesota. And I mean, at this point, because it's been pulled back and there was enough hue and cry in the culture that even the politicians who had brought it to pass pulled back from it and said, well, let's get them out of there. That's not really going the direction we thought it was going to go. So I think all of us have looked at it and said, yeah, it may have gotten out of hand a little bit. Well, while it was happening, you can't be too surprised that on the left and in the middle, that stunned disbelief at the level of violence being used by ICE agents in Minnesota was just it was an indicator of something scary to them. Is this the end of liberty? Can I even walk down my street without somebody in a mask and saying that they represent the government, throwing me in a car and making me disappear tomorrow? I mean, this is the weird stuff that was going on in Central Europe leading up to World War II. It's like that. We can't be this way. That's the fear that people were experiencing on that side. And again, it's not completely irrational, roving masked agents entering private homes without properly approved warrants. And I say that on the legal side, as far as I've understood it, that's a legitimate complaint people had. And then shooting two citizens that we talked about before, Renee Good and Alex Preddy, whatever you thought about them, I mean, that's a pretty scary idea one way or another. For those who are on the left in the middle, they were stunned by what was happening there. And to back up from that and go to the other side, on the right and in the middle, there was stunned disbelief at the legal enforcement of what would have been, and I'm changing the topic. I'm not talking about the violence right now. There was stunned disbelief over the last several years at the legal enforcement of what would have been absurd opinions throughout most of history. You know, an advocacy of trans rights. Again, I'm not trying to have the debate about it, not trying to say it's right or wrong. I have my views. My school has an official statement on things like this. It's fine. That's not what I'm addressing. I'm making the point that on the right and in the middle, people were stunned at some of the claims that were being made about what needed to be protected for a trans person to be given equal rights in their existence in America. It's not, and it really wasn't, in what I heard, it wasn't. There was some of this, but there wasn't a lot of it. Oh, I'm shocked that you would think a trans person should receive the same protections as anyone else from violence and hatred. It wasn't that. That's not what I heard normally. It was instead this, like, oh, we have to absolutely produce legal protections for prepubescent surgeries to make permanent changes in the gender of somebody before they've even, you know, hit adolescence. And some of that was so shocking to the right. It's like, where's the bottom? You know, what are we trying to protect here? And the fear became overwhelming. And more importantly, the fear, this was the one I heard all the time. It was the fear, whether it was legitimate or not, and I heard this over 30 years of being in ministry, in one form or another, about this particular topic. And whether the fear was legitimate or not, I do not know. But the fear was that we wouldn't, and I say we, ministers, people in, you know, vocational ministry, we wouldn't even be able to speak about certain topics in church without the threat of jail looming over our heads. And there was a sort of celebration of that. Like, I think there were some guys who were fomenting the fear so that they could raise money. And as I look back on it, you know, I can see that. But there was also a legitimate fear among some ministers, like, I think this is how we're going to have to live out our faith in the future. We're just going to have to say things and be willing to go to jail. And that's weird when you grew up in a culture that valued free speech and freedom of religion and all that kind of stuff. And so you can imagine how it turned to fear. If, you know, the thinking about it was, if sermons about Romans 1 suddenly become hate speech, then, you know, does the church lose its ability to speak freely on one side of any political issue? And, you know, are we just going to have to become the kind of people who pat the government on the back and say, good job, and we'll keep serving Jesus? That was the fear that was on the right and even in pretty close to the middle on the right, still on the right, over the last few decades it was present. And I can even give you an example from our college. In other words, what I'm trying to say to you is, if you're sitting in the middle and looking at both rabid sides of this culture right now, and we do have some rabies going on, right? If you're sitting in the middle and looking at that and going, what is wrong with these people? Well, what's wrong is that both people, both sides, have this fear of what the other side is doing. They're going to destroy our country. They're going to destroy our country with a fascist exercise of militaristic power in our streets. And again, I'm not trying to mock or predict the truth of either side right now. We can have those discussions later, another time. But on one side, there's that. On the left, you know, they're going to destroy us with militaristic fascism. And on the other side, there is they're going to destroy us because they're not going to respect the values that we've had from the founding, not just from the founding of our country, but throughout all of history. What's happening to us? And then they have no idea what the culture would look like. And it's like, what? Where's even the foundation of where we're going to live? So you can at least step back and go, okay. I disagree, and I need to convince these people this is not true, but I can understand why they're afraid. I can understand where that would be coming from. Let's see if we can help with it. Again, understanding doesn't mean agreeing. It just means I can see why that person would be so afraid. So I can give you, an example we've experienced over the last many years at our own school. When the left was in charge, you know, running the administration, right, the government administration, then we had to have legal protections carved out, a lot of schools did, for us, so that we could simply decide that we were only going to accept students who agreed with our doctrinal statement. That, you know, just that, just being a private school and saying, well, if you're not a Christian, or if you don't embrace this doctrinal statement, then, you know, this isn't the school, you can't attend here. Being able to do that required us to actually look for a legal statement to protect us, not from some kind of a lawsuit, but so that we could continue to offer to our students the federal grants, you know, that allow them to be able to go to school. And, you know, back then in those days, there were lawyers alerting colleges all over the place to the possibility that the government was even going to use fair housing laws to get at schools if they couldn't get to them directly through their admissions process. That never came to be. I don't think it ever could have come to be, but it was one of the threats. And you can hear how that would get schools together and in fear. New organizations entirely be founded on that kind of fear. And when, and this again, facing our school from the opposite side, when the right is in charge, when they take over the administration, then we realize, oh, we get these threatening letters to say we better couch our words just right, because we're doing, from our perspective, nothing more than just trying to serve some populations better, which our enrollment at the time demonstrated we had neglected in the past. And in both cases, whether it was coming from the right or from the left, The threat was, we're going to withhold federal grants from you if you continue to take these steps. And so it generates some fear. And I can understand why that kind of pressure from each side can put a person in a panicked state. Our entire world is about to be undone. It's easy to catastrophize in the way we think about things. And in fact, that's really the problem now. If you think about it, it's not just that people have fear. It's that our fears turn into this catastrophizing process. And it's bewildering how far we're willing to go in that catastrophizing direction. If you take, you know, some simple examples, if you take censorship in libraries, you can talk about both sides. So if you catastrophize about censorship from the left, and there are all kinds of articles about this, because most people in the culture, even people on the right, are pretty protective of freedom of speech. You know, we really want that. And you find yourself in a minority, even among the people you think are your friends, when you start pulling books from libraries and, you know, wanting to burn them and stuff like that. Just not a great idea, right? So it's easy to find articles about this on the left. There's one article, I'll create a link to in CP Review, that was called Book Banning is More Pernicious Than We Think. And in that article, and this article goes to the extreme, you know, it's worse than you think. We're not just eliminating a few books. If you have censorship in the libraries, we might as well just say goodbye to our society. And I'm not exaggerating. The claim is it's the end of civilization as we know it, because we lose diversity, undermining the cognitive habits that allow for disruptive creativity by saying we can't have books like that in our libraries, which is not a completely invalid argument, you can understand. But I'm saying the catastrophizing is going from that to saying, oh, none of us would ever have any diversity whatsoever, or the loss of empathy that we're going to have because we lose access to the experiences of marginalized groups, or we lose what they referred to in this article as the Promethean fire of creativity because we're not exposed to new ideas and so on. Now, so first of all, I'm for protecting books and libraries. I'm all about giving libraries freedom to put out there what people want to check out, and people have the responsibility to check out the right thing and to be with their kids when their kids are looking at the things. And schools should also have, you know, people in the library who are watching to say, yeah, you know, you're in this age group, you go to this section of the library and you don't go over to that section of the library and so on. So, yeah, whatever. But my point is, all of those fears about how censorship is going to end civilization in America become a lot less catastrophic when you realize that you can still get the books. You know, you got a home, you have a checkbook, and you go down to some other place and go to Half Price Books and get it cheap, you know, whatever. Go to your neighbor, use your little neighborhood library thing. What are those things called? Anyway, you get the idea. So, you know what I'm talking about. So the books don't disappear. It's not that we're destroying publishers over the books they have. I guess there are some people who try to do that, but it just doesn't happen. The catastrophizing from the right, by the way, is just as bad. You know, if you have a book in the library that shows kids something they haven't seen before, well, then obviously they're going to adopt the practice that they find there. I mean, if their eye falls on the words, then their behavior is gone. You could never get them back from it. And that kind of literature would mean that kids are going to be indoctrinated with that group's values. And if you have woke literature in the libraries, and I'm putting that in air quotes, then that means that kids are going to hate themselves. White kids, at least, are going to hate themselves, and they're going to believe that all the minorities are innocent and recreate a Soviet-style communism in America, or move to an already communist state, and they're not going to stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance, for crying out loud, and so on. So that catastrophizing can be brought in, you know, reined in, when you consider having a greater influence on your kids at home than a 5 or 30 minute exposure that they have to a book at school. I mean, seriously, you know, you're their parent, and they have a home, and that's where they're going to learn to be the person they are. So it just makes sense. And again, I'm not saying they shouldn't be protected from anything. I'm saying the catastrophizing can be mitigated if we recognize that it could be limited. And I'm not even saying that to say that the people who fear the end of civilization from censorship are wrong, or the people who fear influences on kids that can be damaging are wrong. I'm not saying it for that reason. I'm saying it for the reason of pointing out that running all the way to the edge of the flat earth and thinking we're all about to fall off of it on one side or the other is not where we always have to end up. That, look, the ultimate fear all of us have, Hebrews 2 makes it obvious this is the case. If you're a follower of Jesus, if you're a Christian, you know this. The ultimate fear we have is of death. On the heels of which comes the fear of losing control, losing freedom, losing our voice, losing our purpose, whatever those other things are, they're all attached to the fear that everything's going to run to death. That statement in Hebrews 2, we're all our lifetime subject to fear of death, that statement in Hebrews 2 is our nature as human beings, that we catastrophize. Oh, if I lose my job, I'm not going to be able to eat. I'm going to end up on the street, and then I'm going to die, and all the people I know are going to die, and I'm not going to be able to. That's where we run. Our minds run there automatically. It doesn't mean it's a good place for them to run. And so we normally, this is the point of the conversation today, is to get to this discussion. We normally think of losing control in physical terms. So that's why when the left sees the police state actions of roving gangs under cover of badge and mask as such a threat to the nation's liberty and future, that's why they would see it that way. And it's why the right would describe, not everybody, I'm talking about the extremists, you know, and it's why the right would describe the immigrant threat as bringing murder and rape and drug addiction and human trafficking to all of our neighborhoods. It's your children that are going to be affected, not just by drugs, not by the immigrants. They're immediately the threat to your family. The reason we do that is because it's in our nature to take things to their extreme and to see the catastrophe that might be impending, you know, at the end of the road down there. And in reality, we're ignoring the control that we've already sacrificed. I said we usually think of losing control in physical terms, but there's obviously a lot more than a physicality to being human and to being, you know, to being a person susceptible to fear. Just being physical doesn't make you susceptible to that kind of fear because it's a psychological fear. So in reality, what we often end up doing is ignoring the control that we've already sacrificed by bifurcating the entire country the way we have into either those who agree with us. You know, this is the gentle, easy way to say it, right? Oh, well, there are those who agree with us. And then you would think you could plug in here. Well, there are those who disagree with us, but we don't say that. There are those who agree with us, or there are those who want to destroy us and everything we hold dear. That's our bifurcation of the culture right now. And because we've already adopted that view of the world, so many of us have, and many, many of us have adopted that view. You know, the extremists on one side or the other are actually fighting to do some of this stuff. A lot of the people who are in the middle of the country, a little to the left and a little to the right, still have this bifurcated view of the world that looks over the edge and says, well, there are these people who agree with me, and yeah, some of them are crazy and they're way too far over here, but, you know, they agree with me. And then there are the people who want to destroy us and everything we hold dear. That's the way we see the world. That mentality is itself evidence of the real control, the outside control, the external control that we've fallen prey to. And it's not new. It's not like something we have to find in some mysterious way. In fact, so this would be the most abstract part of the conversation, if you can hang with me through it for a minute. I find it fascinating, and it might even give you a book or two that you want to read or that you end up reading and then wishing you hadn't. In the late 20th century, and in particular, I mean the 60s, 70s, little into the 80s, in the late 20th century, there was this effort to draw our attention to a different kind of control than what we had been aware of in the past. I'm about to say the most hypocritical thing ever. Now, this is not a conspiracy theory, but let me give you a conspiracy. It has nothing to do with conspiracy. There's no they. There's no them. There's no organized group or disorganized conglomerate that's bringing this to pass. It's just the way our society functions, and it's the way we function as people. So not a conspiracy for that reason, not because I want you to believe it, but not believe that you're listening to a wild conspiracy theorist. It's not about some, you know, weird hidden technique of control that a group has figured out and, you know, managed to manipulate us with, even though there is some of that manipulation, which you're aware of in social media, for instance, and you know the routines that make it possible there. It's just an observation that what I'm trying to make. It's just an observation about how people who see themselves almost entirely in psychological terms, and that's all of us, we see ourselves that way in the West. That's how we understand who we are. We are therapeutic beings. We believe that we're whole and healthy when our psychology is whole and healthy. And what we're looking for is to be happy, to be satisfied, to be content, to be all those things. And functional, obviously, in society. When somebody's not, we say, something's wrong there and we need to address that, get them fixed and plug them back in so they can fit in society the way they ought to fit in society. I don't even think there's anything terrible about anything. That's how we see each other. That's how we see ourselves. So it's really funny about how we can be people who see ourselves almost entirely in psychological terms, and therefore, and this part's not funny, this is just a reality, inherently, we're going to be increasingly shaped by psychological pressures because that's how we see ourselves. That's the most important thing to us. Am I in a healthy place? Am I practicing self-care? I'm not making fun of it. It's important that you have self-care. It's important that you balance the things in your life so that you can have that psychological place of peace or whatever you want to refer to it as. Even the way we interpret scripture is largely shaped by that. It's how we understand contentment and peace and what faith brings that nothing else would bring. It's how we read Philippians 4. It's how I think Paul intended for us to read Philippians 4, but maybe without so much of the clinical psychological language that we give to it later. I'm getting off the beaten path, back to the journey here. So historically, the things that we used to control each other, and again, no conspiracy, not like they're doing this. Ooh, those people who run the world. Everybody runs the world. We're all part of the society. We all create part of the structures and the system that makes it work. And we all value things a certain amount so that we can tolerate some other pressures that allow us to serve together in the society or live together in the society. So historically, in societies, we used physical punishments and rewards to shape behavior. There were, not just the actions themselves, like throwing people into prison, but also the threat of throwing people into prison and the enticement of rewards. Maybe you didn't get the reward, but you knew it was a possibility. And so threats and enticements go along with the punishments and the rewards. And the interesting is that the further from physical that they became, those threats and enticements and punishments and rewards, the further from physically actual they get, the more psychological they naturally become. They are appealing to a mental state, our fear or our longing or our desire or whatever it is. I mean, it's an obvious thing. There's no genius in this. You can understand it. But again, and I'm not creating this argument. I'm not creating this historical recognition or this sociological perspective. It's a prominent perspective, like I said, especially throughout the 1970s, that was being established in a lot of really fine scholarship, some pretty good scholarship. And so there are these, in the same way that there are physical punishments and rewards, there are psychological punishments and rewards. There's psychological punishments like shame. So historically, you know, put a person in front of them, tell them that they're doing terrible things in front of the entire congregation, for instance, in church discipline. And there are rewards like praise. I compliment you for having accomplished this goal. We put around your neck the garland of success, you know, whatever it is. Those things are more psychological and less physical in terms of what would motivate people. And so there are, along with those actual psychological punishments and rewards, psychological threats and enticements. That same thing could happen to you. This same thing could happen to you. If you're bad, you're good, whatever. And so a lot of writers and thinkers in the 1970s and beyond argued, among other things, that those psychological threats and enticements over time took the place of the physical threats over time. So if you read Michel Foucault's Discipline and Punish or Madness and Civilization, which I don't super highly recommend, by the way, they're fascinating. Michel Foucault especially is a really interesting author, and he's very creative, and he is extremely knowledgeable. So he's Just the cross references that are in his works are worth the reading. So I'm not discouraging you from reading it, but I will say he makes some pretty outlandish leaps as well. I say outlandish; they're not outlandish; they're just not justified. And so I'm no competition with Michel Foucault. He's one of the great minds of the 20th century. He's just way off base on a few things. Most people would agree. Not everybody agrees, but most people would. And so, read him with, a grain of salt. I think a better author on the topic is Klaus Derner, who I recommended to a student recently. I've got an independent study, or a directed study, as they call it, with a student who's reading this work called Mad Men and the Bourgeoisie that makes the point as well. A pretty seminal work in the concept that we, over time, replaced sort of physical prisons with these psychological means for shaping people to fit into society better and to remain in the center of where we need them to be in society. And again, not we like the elites or, the conspired group of oligarchists or something like that. Nothing like that. That's the same way, by the way, I would say in our culture, people sometimes think about the tech oligarchs, like they're colluding together to manipulate society into this. And you could hear me saying this, into this bifurcated animus, this animosity that, and so on. There doesn't need to be a collusion. They're generating a product that we want. And so they're going to do whatever makes it work for us to keep clicking and selling ads. And if they're selling ads and making money, they're doing the business thing. They're doing the entrepreneurial thing. So it doesn't take an evil genius to be the head of the tech company. It just takes a person who's really smart at getting us the product we wanted in our hands so that we didn't have to pay attention to the person who's eating dinner across the table from us. Too much there, wasn't there? Anyway, the point is, we do the same thing by turning it into a conspiracy when it's not, but it's not. It's just the way our society is shaped right now. We're largely shaped by these psychological forces. So one example of that transition, that movement towards psychological control in society, not centered in a conspiracy, just the way society functions, is an extrapolation that some of those authors make from Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon. If you haven't heard of it all, I'm not going to go all the way down this weird scholarly road. But the point of the Panopticon is that you have something of a prison and you don't need 100 guards for 1,000 prisoners because you put this thing in the middle of it that the prisoners can't see into, but the guard can see out of. So the prisoners never know whether they're being watched or not. So they sort of police themselves. And that has become, over time, an analogy of how people see our culture overall, that we don't even have to have people watching us. We have internalized the controls psychologically so that we behave in certain ways in our nature. Now, I'm not going to go down the road of all the criticism that a lot of people on both sides, left and right, make about how terrible it is that we control ourselves in this way and that we've internalized what should be social controls and then we should fight against the social controls and so on. I'm not even going down that road. I just want to make the point that there's a really strong parallel between what's happening with social media and the Panopticon, the idea that somebody is manipulating us psychologically so that we internalize these controls and become this or that. In this case, it's not that the flow of information, like who's being watched and who's watching, is one-sided in that prison, the Panopticon, you can imagine, because the prisoners don't get the information. They don't know who's watching them. Only the guard gets the information. He gets to see whatever he wants to look at, whichever direction he wants to look, and that's the person that's punished. And if somebody's punished, then everybody else is like, oh, we better not do it. They could be watching us. That's the singular flow of information. But in this case, the information that flows from the central source actually obscures whatever facts might lie behind that flow. Let me explain what I mean by that. With social media, what I mean by that is we're scrolling, and the routines, the algorithms that are built into it. And in fact, I noticed the other day on some social media platform, I can't remember which one of the options it gave me was see your algorithm. So we'll show you what it is that's causing us to put into your feed, whatever's in your feed. So here we've got these algorithms that are feeding us, but we don't pay attention to that. That part is generally invisible to us. They'd like to make it visible. so that we'll stop complaining about it, but we wouldn't care. We would read it and not care. What we want is to see the stuff we want to see in our feed. And as long as we're seeing the stuff we want to see, we're happy with it. In that information flow, we don't get to see why that piece of information is there. Well, you enjoy reading deceptive articles. And so I'm going to put a bunch of lies in front of you. We don't see that. We just see the article. And so, well, it's got to be. I mean, absolutely, you know, it's written down. So it's the first piece of information I'm getting about this certain event. So it must be the case. And we just adopt that view. That information flow obscures the facts that actually lie behind the flow. So we end up controlled not by overt threats or enticements, but by this psychological urge for the reward of clicking the information. And really, it's just empty data most of the time. It's stuff that is just being created so that we can look at something we want to look at. It's like reading novels all the time and thinking that's the real world. It doesn't have to be completely false to be false. The whole point of it is we're reading stuff and we think, oh, well, that's got a little anchor in reality, so it must be true, in the same way we read novels and do that as well. When I read science fiction, I like the science fiction best that has some case for why it might actually be possible. That's what makes it interesting to me. So we do the same thing with the stuff we're clicking in social media. I'm not telling you anything new about that. That's just built into how social media works. So our problem, though, is that when we're getting all that empty data, we know it's going to stimulate our mind with the pleasure we derive from agreeing with pleasant information, or it's going to stimulate our mind with the pleasure we get from mocking or disagreeing with contrary information. We like both ways of being motivated. Ooh, I hate that guy. Ooh, that feels good. So what we have found our way to is, in this bifurcated society, in this society where we seem like we're tearing each other apart, we're going to destroy each other the way Guernica is depicted, you know, by Picasso in Spain, that we have found our way to this decentralized wonder of human cooperation. It is amazing in economics. It's amazing that people who don't share the same goals at all can cooperate in a society and actually help each other accomplish their goals. It's part of what a liberal, free society is all about, this wonder that you can have a human cooperation that works even when we don't have to agree with each other completely. What's amazing is that in our way of being driven by our urges to look at the news that motivates us with the pleasure or the hatred that we want to pursue, that we found a way to motivate that cooperation, not to cooperate with each other about, you know, whether we're going to wear masks or not, or get vaccines or not for communicable diseases. We don't agree with each other about that, heaven forbid, or solving complex or inherent social dilemmas. We're not going to agree with each other about that. How do we address poverty? Well, the government gives them money, or the government stops giving them money. We don't agree with each other about that at all. That's not where we found cooperation. We found the way to cooperate with each other in, this is insane. We have found a way to cooperate with each other in maintaining a society in which we optimize our exposure to anyone and everyone, to anything and everything, which can foment even more disdain and fear of the opposition on both sides. We have, from the far left and the far right, found a way to maintain our tension with each other and actually make it even greater from one political cycle to the next. Now, that is a stable society. Unbelievable cooperation. We can cooperate with each other about how much more we want to kill each other every day. Political parties benefit from it because it motivates fundraising. Tech companies profit from it because it motivates clicks. And we get to feel more important since we're staying informed about the world-ending apocalyptic events shaping our everyday lives. Every single day, I get to see 30 different examples of how the world's going to end tomorrow. Aren't we lucky to live in such a gloriously self-important age? It's just, shouldn't we do better? So how do we do that? I'm going to give you the same. So first of all, we could articulate better. I am going to give you the same answer I give every time to this, which is to stop trying to fix everyone else and start looking at ourselves. That's why I said this would end in self-examination. And so what do I look at in myself? Because my problem is I'm just as susceptible to all of these influences as everyone else. I experience the same fears as everyone else. I experience on one end or the other, but I'm still going to experience it. And I'm still being motivated to lean into that fear and maintain this system that we've created in our society that functions this way. How on earth am I supposed to get out of that? I mean, I'm part of the problem. And that's what I'm saying. All of us, every one of us ought to stop thinking everybody else is the problem and back up and say, I wonder if I'm the problem. The answer to that question is yes. I am the problem. Now, I can't come to you and tell you why you're the problem, but I can give you some tools that have helped me to back up and see my flaws. If you're not comfortable with self-loathing, I understand you may be reluctant to listen to this part of the episode, but I encourage you to listen to it anyway, because you don't actually have to hate yourself to want to fix yourself, to get a little better, right? Even just to get on your knees and ask for help, which is what all of us can do. Even if we can't fix ourselves, we can ask for someone to fix us. And I've got just the right person in mind when I say that. So what can we do? Self-examination. Let me give you a few keywords. I'll give you four keywords and then just a closing idea. Number one, community. Just community. You know, the word I would put into community to make, you know, to say this is what it means is empathy. But I'm not just saying become more empathetic. Let your heart bleed more, you know. Make all your very conservative friends call you a bleeding heart liberal. I'm not saying that. But I am saying when you're in a community, it's because you find part of your identity in that community. It's because you find your values shared with the people who are in that community. And so when I say community, I don't just mean remember that you're part of a very tight-knit community that's being destroyed by the community across the way. That doesn't do us any good at all. Remember that you're part of a bigger community than that. You're part of a community that's living on both extremes in total fear of each other. And if that becomes our community, then our empathy suddenly grows to include the people we used to be glad were dying, but instead look at and say, oh, man, they were going to go home and eat just like I was. They were going to go home and talk to their kids just like I was. They were just they had a job, and they disagreed with me on the policies here, and I think those were important policies, and I think they were leading the country the wrong way, but this person was destroyed. Remember that every person you see is a person. That's what I mean by saying remember you're part of community. Renee Good, Alex Pretty, and Charlie Kirk all got up a year ago, had breakfast, planned for the next days of their lives, and wanted to do something to influence the people who are around them. And now they're dead. They don't get to learn what they could have adjusted to be a better influence over time. They don't get to change their mind. They don't get to have a birthday with their family or cajole their friends about something important or silly. They don't get to hear the still small voice of God redirect their lives to something worth more than anything they had ever committed themselves to before. They don't get that. How could we not care that a person bearing the image of God lost what God put them into the world for in that death? So in community, I'm just saying remember that other people are people, that other persons are persons. Don't dehumanize, in other words. Plurality. That's the second one. Plurality. This is the idea. Some people don't like this idea, but I mean, how can you not like the idea if you read the Bible at all? It's the multitude of counselors idea. It's three times. I'll read you three proverbs that say the same, that make this same point, different ways. Where there is no guidance, a people falls, but an abundance of counselors, in them there is safety. It's not just, I have a bunch of counselors telling me the same thing. The point of an abundance of counselors is that you have people giving you different opinions. We need a plurality of opinions. We need people who see the world in a way we don't see the world. And the other proverb, without counsel, plans fail, but with many advisors, they succeed. We need a lot of them, not just one who gives us a perspective we agree with. We need the advisors who say things we didn't think of or didn't agree with before. The last one that I'll mention to you. For by wise guidance you can wage your war, and in abundance of counselors there is victory. One opinion is not enough. Plurality means I need to hear the opinions of other people. And when I hear them, not just dismiss it out of hand. Oh, he's on the left. Oh, he's woke. Or on the right. Oh, he's a fascist. Oh, all he wants to do is control my thoughts. All they want to do is impose their religion on us. Mm-mm, that's not good enough. I need to hear what they're saying. And if nothing else, at least say, why do they want to do that? What is it that's going on there? Because we've grown up in the same society, but we're thinking about it from completely different ways. That's what it would mean to have a plurality of opinions that you're listening to. Humanity, third term. So I gave you community, plurality, humanity. This is your humanity. I remember my son, Philip, saying to his kids, look, we're not just content consumers, we're creators. I was really proud to hear that line, by the way. I love that idea, and I love that concept, and my son's always been that way. He is a content creator. He loves to create things. He's always been creative. And all of my kids are that way in one way or another. I love that about them. And that's true about all of us as human beings. In other words, God didn't just make us little animals. We're not just part of the herd. We don't just have to repeat what we've heard before, and we don't just have to do what everybody else is doing. You're not just a consumer of prefabricated narratives. The story that you've heard is not the only story to be told. And God has made you to create a story of your own. He has made you to create a vector in the path that you've been on and go a different direction. He has made you to do something other than simply what the herd has done. Otherwise, you would not have been introduced as an agent into this world, but you are. You can go back and listen to the conversations we had about Augustine and love to make sense of all of that. So community, plurality, humanity. The last term I'll give you is agency. If you're not happy with the way things are unfolding in the world right now, then stop contributing to it. I know what you're thinking. Oh, I'm not happy with the way things are unfolding in the world right now, so I'm going to kill all those other people. That's not what this means, because that's not the way the world is right now. The world is not left right now. The world is not right right now. The world is bifurcated. The world is filled with animosity from one side to the other and total fear of each other. If you don't like the way things are unfolding in the world right now, then stop contributing to it. If you don't like the wild swings that are happening in the seesaw, then stop standing on the very end of the beam. Maybe the beam needs to go down a little on this side. Maybe it needs to go down a little on that side. But what it doesn't need is just more dead weight piled on at either end. In other words, I'm saying, you know, so in metaphors, smell your food before you eat it. Make sure you've paid attention to what you're about to put into your mouth before you eat it. I could tell you some stories about that from the past I regret. Test the water before you dive in. We had a swimming pool when I was a kid, and I dove in a few times and regretted not testing the water before I dove in. And what I mean by this is judge yourself. You're the water. You're the food. Your mind's state is already in a certain place. Maybe you should test that before you commit fully to following the direction that very shaped and influenced mind might take you if you don't examine yourself. So judge yourself, your motives, your influences, a lot more before you stand in front of everyone else with a giant post hanging out of your eye. I'm talking Matthew 7:1, you know. So who knows whether in addition to removing your own blinders, we might, to quote my favorite New Testament source, save a soul from death and hide a multitude of sins. Given the multitude of sins around us on every side right now, hiding a few of them might not be the worst thing we did this year.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.